chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass makes heaven in the middle of it. Grass makes heaven in the middle. We are grass makes heaven.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got some interesting clips today to play for you. And the first one is an extended clip, and it's an interview that Alex Jones had with Jason Goodman, and I'll tell you, it's very, very insightful. They get into Jeffrey Epstein and just a lot of very, very interesting things. And then the last clip is an interview that Diana West had, and she tells us about some of the background on James Comey and several other people. So this is very important information, so listen closely. Thank you for being with us this evening.
Late last week, Jason Goodman, a interviewer, talk show host, talked to Alan Dershowitz, Jeffrey Epstein's lawyer, and he said, I'll plunge a needle in your arm. You're going to take the shot. You don't like to leave America. Well, I looked at the Supreme Court cases. What he said is not true. There's informed consent. If someone has a disease, you can claim it's communicable and try to lock them up for treatment, but you can't say everyone's locked up. But Jason Goodman wants to go down the rabbit hole and get into Alan Dershowitz, what he really represents, torture, and so much more. But here's some of what Mr. Dershowitz had to say.
Legitimate. Let me put it very clearly. You have no constitutional right to endanger the public and spread a disease, even if you disagree. You have no right not to be vaccinated. You have no right not to wear a mask. You have no right to open up your business.
Wait, can I stop you?
Yeah.
No right not to be vaccinated, meaning if they decide you have to be vaccinated, we have to be vaccinated?
Absolutely. And if you refuse to be vaccinated, the state has the power to literally take you to a doctor's office and plunge a needle into your arm. If the vaccination
Where is that in the Constitution?
To prevent, if the vaccination is designed to prevent the spreading disease. If the vaccination is only to prevent a disease that you will get. For example, if there's a disease that will kill you, you have the right to refuse that, but you have no right to refuse to be vaccinated against a contagious disease. Public health, the police power of the Constitution, gives the state the power to compel that, and there are cases in the United States Supreme Court. Case that pops into my head, I may have the name wrong, is Jacobson. I think probably I have it right. Check it out. You'll see that there are cases after cases after cases that the public health permits reasonable actions to prevent the spread of communicable. Well, I want to make sure it's well understood, and I don't think we'd ever get legislation passed unless there was a very, very widespread consensus across the board. Remember how hard it is to get legislation enacted in this country. Got to get the House of Representatives. You got to get the Senate to approve the same language that the House approves. You got to get the President to sign the bill. Then you got to get the courts to uphold it. Once all of those checks and balances have been satisfied, that's the democracy we live in. And you know, if you don't like it, there are other places you can go to.
Not really. They won't let us leave New York. Let me ask you this, because
you can leave New York. You can leave New York. If you tell them you want to give up your American citizenship and go to another country, you can leave New York. Yeah.
Let's stay focused on this research for a second.
Right.
So in this visit to Harvard.
So we're a constitutional republic, not a democracy. He made a lot of claims there that just on its face, and the court case he cites isn't true. The idea that there aren't liabilities with these vaccines, they don't cause problems. Who says they're safe? I mean, I went and looked this up, Jason Goldman. None of this was true. You lay that out as well. So go ahead in the time we have, about 6 minutes to break. Counter what Alan Dershowitz just said post-interview, what you researched. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Alex. It's just to be clear, that Jacobson versus Massachusetts, that is a real case. And what he's citing is true. There was a Swedish immigrant in 1905 who lived in Massachusetts, and the law at the time mandated that adults and children needed to be vaccinated against smallpox. Now, you heard Alan Dershowitz tell me to look it up, which I did, and I've been studying it basically all week since he said that. And it, what he said is true, but he is gaslighting the public. I want to set your viewers at ease, Alex. What he said is wrong, because he's talking about the police powers of the Constitution, and the law is not black and white. The law frequently has caveats and qualifiers in it, like these police powers cannot be used arbitrarily or oppressively. And here's the important thing. This is something I really want people to absorb, Alex. The very first vaccine that was ever developed was the smallpox vaccine. And by 1905, when Jacobson was taking on the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the smallpox vaccine had been in use for 109 years. It was developed in 1796. So despite the safety risks of that vaccine, it had been given to literally millions of people around the world. There was over 100 years of medical and scientific debate about the safety, the efficacy, and there was a general understanding of that vaccine. Now, here's the key. The vaccine that's been proposed in this Operation Warp Speed, President Trump has brought in this former pharmaceutical executive as the vaccine czar. This uses a new generation of technology. It's not a traditional vaccine that introduces...
It's mRNA that takes over the cells and reprograms. I mean, you're absolutely right that that case was later overturned. You can say if somebody's infected, maybe you quarantine them. They're saying everyone is suspect. Everyone is locked down. Everyone must take these shots. It's just outrageous.
Well, and the thing is, they've never made a vaccine using mRNA technology before.
And they bypassed animal trials. Who the hell allowed
that?
That's illegal.
Well, not only is it illegal, it's basically proposing, according to Alan Dershowitz, that every single American will be forced
to be a guinea pig. But listen, you're a smart guy, probably smarter than I am, Jason. What I'm saying here is I look at the law. No, seriously, they're not allowed to bypass animal trials under federal law. How is this happening? How is Moderna, meaning the mother in Spanish, and these other three companies with Bill and Melinda Gates doing human testing in the United States right now with a vaccine that bypassed humans?
I can't speak to exactly the legal process they went through to
do
that.
It's unprecedented.
It is. It is. And particularly that it's such a new type of technology. They're going to be doing DNA experiments inside everyone's body. They don't know the outcome. So you cannot compare this to the vaccine that was being debated in Jacobson v. Massachusetts, because there is no medical consensus on this. And Alan Dershowitz is mixing the concept of scientific proof with the concept of a legal proof, and he can't do that. I'm curious to know what Alan Dershowitz would say about a legal opinion offered by a medical doctor with no legal training, because he is giving us his medical opinion as a lawyer, and he doesn't know what he's talking
about.
Since
when is Alan Dershowitz and Bill Gates our doctors?
They're not. He doesn't know what he's talking about on this, Alex. He's totally wrong, and he's refused to follow up and debate me on this because he doesn't want to be embarrassed by a non-lawyer telling him what the Constitution says.
Well, I was about to say, I'm surprised that YouTube hasn't taken your videos down that have got millions of views because you destroyed him. I mean, with just common sense.
Well, it's, you know, here's the interesting thing. A social engineering operation began as soon as I released this video. And what they did was they isolated those segments where Dershowitz is talking about the vaccine, the mandatory vaccination, and they've been blasting those out. That's definitely gotten millions of views. But here's the kicker, Alex. That's not even the most important thing that he said in our interview. And that's not to say that the concept of forced vaccination isn't important. What I'm saying is Dershowitz's opinion about that is important because he's not in the government. He's not the president.
So we're going to come back with it. What is the most important part?
He's trying to deflect people away from things that he said about Jeffrey Epstein, Bill Clinton, the Rothschild, Harvard.
Oh, I get it. He's changing the subject by coming up with forced inoculation away from the hounds on him for being Jeffrey Epstein's lawyer.
Right. Big thing.
All right. Well, your Skype's cutting up. I'm sure it's probably us, but powerful stuff. Jason Goodman, where has he been all my life? This guy's amazing videos. Since I found his YouTube channel, he reaches millions of people. I didn't even know who he was. Then later, years ago, I knew who he was, but now I've rediscovered him. He's coming up straight ahead with powerful interviews. We're going to break down where this is going next. On the other side, I'm Alex Jones, InfoWars.com, NewsWars.com, Tomorrow's News Today. I mean, think about that. This is the fear-mongering to kill the economy. But let's go back to our guest. Jason Goodman is a very smart fella. He's at Twitter at CSTCS, The Truth, and on YouTube, Jason Goodman. And I was actually familiar with his work. I'm like, wait a minute, I've seen this guy. Done work for a long time exposing deep state. How'd you get Dershowitz on? And then you want to skip past him with the forced inoculation, because you're right, the media made that about it. But you got him to get into a whole bunch of stuff. Because here's the deal. I know people deserve lawyers. So if you're an axe murderer, you're a child molester, you're an arsonist, you deserve a lawyer. But I started noticing about 2 years ago these whisper campaigns by the lawyers, like, why don't you say something nice about Alan Dershowitz on air? I'm like, I'm not even thinking about Alan Dershowitz. Then other people like, oh, we heard you say something about Alan Dershowitz. If you do that, you better watch out. Who is Alan Dershowitz? Why is he so mobbed up? I mean, I got some heat for exposing Epstein. I got some heat for exposing the Clintons. I got some heat for exposing, you know, all these groups, but the Bushes, you name it. But, man, when I mess with Dershowitz, I guess he just knows all the secrets. Who is this guy? Because, you know, now that I'm told I'm not supposed to talk about it, I'm going to start talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I feel, Alex. I met him outside the courthouse at 500 Pearl Street when I went to attend Gefree v. Dershowitz, which is one of Jeffrey Epstein's victims, is suing Alan Dershowitz for defamation because, you know, Virginia Roberts Gefree claims that Alan Dershowitz had sex with her. Dershowitz called her a liar. She sued for defamation. She's represented by David Boies, who is ostensibly this, like, you know, arch enemy of Alan Dershowitz. But I don't know. Is all this fighting in civil lawsuits? There was just an article in, I think, the Daily Mail yesterday or the day before that a civil lawsuit between Ghislaine Maxwell and Virginia Gefree has now allowed Maxwell's lawyer to enter a motion to stay the civil suit for fear that the discovery process in the civil suit will hamper Maxwell's Fifth Amendment rights in the criminal suit. So,
well, just to be clear, I actually know about all these law firms involved. I'll leave it at that. They get their clients engaged with each other. I think there's a fight, but above, there's political deals being made.
Right. I agree with you. I think that there's more to some of these civil lawsuits than might meet the eye.
Oh, believe me, I know.
Yeah. So I met him outside the courthouse. I asked him what I thought were some difficult questions, which he responded to. And then I just, you know, I have several, you know, databases, public databases that I subscribe to, and found his phone number in there. You got to search often and go through a lot of different numbers. But I called him up. He answered, agreed to a telephone interview a few months ago. And I've just been calling him ever since, trying to get him back on the show. There's a lot of questions I wanted to ask him. And, you know, I asked him about the constitutionality of what Emmett Sullivan has been doing to Michael Flynn. I asked him about the constitutionality of Governor Andrew Cuomo, specifically disallowing people to peaceably assemble in City Hall.
We're going to get to that next segment, but let me just ask you as a smart investigative journalist, because you I look at your work, you do a lot of great work.
Thank you.
What's up with Dershowitz? Like, who does he really represent? Why is he so... I mean, what do you think is really going on here? I mean, now you go off the facts you have, but what is happening here?
It's difficult to say, Alex. You know, he was one of the youngest, Charles Ortel was telling me that when Alan Dershowitz became, you know, whatever it was, professor, now he's, you know, professor emeritus at Harvard, but when he became this, you know, big muckety-muck at Harvard, he was the youngest guy to ever do that. And he's super connected through Harvard, where Charles Lieber, the nanotechnology expert, was indicted in January. We've got the WIS Institute that's developing DNA nanobots that are smaller than viruses, can enter your cells, and can release a payload. Now, what that payload is...
All right,
and what
so
it
it's
does,
Bill Gates again, who we know finances all of it. So it's a Bill Gates operation.
I think so. I think so. I think you're right. So I don't know what Alan Dershowitz is all about, but he lied about me and our conversation on his interview with Del Bigtree on the High Wire just yesterday. And I take issue with that. He said I blindsided him with this question about the vaccine, which is totally untrue. I was asking him about Andrew Cuomo's ability to prevent us from peacefully assembling in the park. And he said, let me be clear, the police powers allow the state to take you and against your will inject
you. That's right. I've watched the whole interview. You were very calm, like you are now, very nice. And you didn't blindside or cut him out of context?
No. And even when I asked him about Jeffrey Epstein, it was in the context of trying to discern what Jeffrey Epstein was doing at Harvard, interacting with Larry Summers, the president, interacting with, you know, all these different top
level
scientists.
What is your best understanding? I know you just go off as a journalist, but I mean, what is going on with Epstein?
You know, Alex, I think he was running a sexual entrapment blackmail organization because, you know, I don't think a lot of high level.
No, I agree. So then who for? I mean, I think there's a group at the top of all the, I think it's all the major intelligence agencies.
It's hard to say who for, but, you know, Dershowitz during our conversation made the ridiculous statement that he did not know that Epstein was alleged to be involved with intelligence. And he even said Alexander Acosta, the former labor secretary, who was the U.S. attorney in Florida who made this sweetheart deal with Dershowitz for Epstein to keep him out of jail, he said that Acosta lied when he said that he was told to lay off of Epstein because he was intelligence. And
so
I mean,
let me ask you this. Do you think Dershowitz is above Epstein?
I think that Dershowitz is a tool of the deep state who is engaged in lawfare. He is using lawsuits and the legal system as a weapon against political enemies, and he's using it in ways that are not necessarily obvious to the layperson. I think that he's a social engineer who goes on places like Fox News, which we should note is controlled by News Corp, Rupert Murdoch's company that also owns the New York Post, which has essentially been the clearinghouse for all information about Jeffrey Epstein. New York Post is the only newspaper to present a photograph of Epstein on the gurney going into New York Presbyterian Hospital. Didn't look like Epstein to me, Alex. You've seen the photo. Was that Epstein?
I've been sued over the photo, actually. We just showed it on air, and I got sued by the guy that took it. Yeah, they don't want us talking about it. Listen, I don't have some swing in, you know what, for Epstein or anybody. I just know I'm told, leave this alone. I'm like, well, what am I supposed to do? And then it just gets crazier and crazier. So let me ask you this, Jason Goodman. How do you think it's going for the establishment right now? I don't think they're very happy.
Panic mode, total panic mode. I mean, you know, they're running a social engineering operation just in terms of me. Obviously, they're doing tons of things. I think the whole COVID-19 outbreak is a social engineering operation where they've basically, you know, convinced everyone, if you're not in New York City right now, Alex, even if you're not afraid of the virus, going outside, it's about a 99.9% guarantee of some kind of confrontation with a person telling you to wear a mask.
It's the craziness of the people that's dangerous.
Yes, correct. And the police, NYPD smashing people on the sidewalk for not wearing masks, not doing the social distancing.
Oh, there's no doubt. China was in trouble in Hong Kong and Taiwan. Deep State was in trouble with Epstein. The British family was in trouble. They hit the panic button. This is their panic button.
I agree. I think this is a plan that has been wargamed for a long time. The concept of releasing some kind of pathogen.
Lockstep,
maybe they already.
201.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we know that the Clintons were involved in a virus harvesting scandal, taking blood from convicts in the Arkansas prison system, and then they sold that blood.
Clinton blood scandal.
Right. Connaught Laboratories in Canada. Lots of people got hepatitis and HIV, but maybe they were trying to extract viruses from that blood.
Oh, exactly. The day after I had the doctor on that exposed it, they firebombed his facility in Little Rock and the Hemophiliac Society in Canada.
Holy cow. I didn't know about that, but I think that they've been researching, you know, biowarfare on the general public for a long time. And technologies like nanotech, these DNA bots that can deliver payloads to individual cells. I mean, listen, Alex, you know this to be true, and your viewers know this to be true. The Washington Post, which is a rag, obviously.
Hold on, stay there. We're going to come right back with Jason Goodman. Jason Goodman, CS The Truth. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Alex Jones, your host. Investigative journalist Jason Goodman is our guest. It's real simple. You go buy your, Jason, I mean, I knew the globalists were into genetic engineering and playing God and all sorts of weird crap and cloning. And I remember 15 years ago, articles in the Wall Street Journal and New York Times trying to hide it in plain view. Oh, Bill Gates and, you know, they got a manager that runs it, Jeffrey Epstein, and they're with Oprah Winfrey and Ted Turner and Warren Buffett and who's the guy that founded CNN? Ted Turner. They're all there. Founding a world government for depopulation. So obviously, this is the James Bond supervillain group. They're allowed to be tax-free. They do whatever they want. What is Epstein doing? He's going around as a gopher compromising people. Then you've got a lawyer involved and get stuff swept under the rug of the Justice Department. From your deep research, what do you think this is?
Well, you've just said it, Alex. It's essentially a James Bond-style criminal organization. I mean, the people that you just named, you're talking about billionaires. We've now heard that there are individuals who are going to be the first trillionaire. You know, you look at Bill Gates. Let's just talk about Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, George Soros, Warren Buffett. Those four guys control over $400 billion. Go look up the GDP of every country in the world. Those four guys control more money than the GDP for, like, you know, the top 50 countries. So they can act like countries. And I've been trying to interview epigeneticists and endocrinologists, and they talk to me quite a bit on the phone, but nobody wants to go on the record because every single one of these hospitals, research facilities, or whatever, is getting funding from groups that are controlled by
these. So what's the big secret? What are they really trying to do? Because they act like they're trying to stop something from happening. It's like they're acting like they're trying to suppress things.
Well, what they're trying to do is, I think, they're trying to make everyone super afraid of everybody else so that we can't get together and talk about these things and share this information in the way that you
exactly.
and I are.
We can't get together in groups. I mean, that's the ultimate martial law.
Correct, and that's a violation of the Constitution, and that's what I was asking Dershowitz about that led to all this other
stuff. Yeah, you've got a bunch of clips. Which ones do you want to play? Because you're right. Everybody looked at your clip of him saying, I'm going to plunge a needle in your arm. Nobody looked at, I mean, I've played some clips, but you've got Dershowitz tell how Rothschild introduced him to Epstein. Let's play that clip right now.
Yeah.
Here it is. Let's play clip one.
I was his lawyer, so my name may have been attached to the letter, but I don't have any personal knowledge. I know that Epstein and Clinton were very, very close. I remember a situation. This is a name-dropping story where I was having dinner. My wife and I were having dinner with Caroline Kennedy at Caroline Kennedy's home on Martha's Vineyard. And the president, President Clinton, was there. And he received a phone call. The Secret Service gave him the phone. And he went off on the side, and he had a long conversation. And then he came over to me, President Clinton did, and said, somebody wants to talk to you. I said, who? He said, well, get on the phone. And it was Jeffrey Epstein, who had been talking to the president for, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes before the phone was handed to me. And then he just asked me how I was doing. I had met him on the vineyard through Lady Rothschild, the wife of the Lord Rothschild, who told me he was this wonderful man. He had connections to Harvard. He was very charitable. He was giving $30 million to Harvard. Would I do her a favor and meet with him? And I did. I met with him at my house. He left a bottle of champagne, which I still haven't opened, and probably won't ever drink. but I had an academic relationship with him until he was arrested. Then the relationship stopped being in any way academic or personal and became entirely professional. I charged him for every minute that I spent on his case, gave him no discounts, and produced a very good result. I'm very proud of the result we produced. That's my job.
Okay, so please tell us what's really going on there, Jason.
Well, the question that I asked him that led to that was about this letter that Alan Dershowitz has signed at a time that he was Jeffrey Epstein's lawyer. This was part of this plea deal that was made with Alexander Acosta. In the letter, it says that Jeffrey Epstein was one of the individuals who helped President Clinton form the Clinton Global Initiative. Now, Charles Ortel has been doing a four-year-long investigation where he's presenting IRS documents, official filings from the Clinton Foundation. The Clinton Global Initiative was never legally organized. It violates IRS code with regard to how a 501c3 tax...
And is it really a spinoff of these weird, secretive Bill Gates seems to be at the center of all these secret foundations and funding of literally thousands of groups.
That's right. And there's a lot of these foundations. They all seem to have foundations. And Epstein had the Humpty Dumpty Foundation. I mean, what they're doing is they have these tax-exempt foundations.
Well, we're not being gross. That was the name of his penis, right?
I don't know about that, but it's interesting to note that
an egg-shaped. I mean, I'm not trying to be gross.
Oh, yeah, that's true. No, that's true. But it was also a book written by Donald Barr called The Humpty Dumpty Effect, and Donald Barr was the headmaster of Dalton School just months before Jeffrey Epstein became a math teacher.
Sure, I wasn't trying to be gross there. I was told that, like, in the cult, there's some weird thing to do with. I don't know how cults work, but there's some weird thing to do with Epstein's male member. I wasn't just saying that to be gross here.
No. I think victims have made that allegation. But the point is they're using these foundations, Alex, to shuffle money around from one to the other. And, I mean, as far as the Clinton Global Initiative is concerned, it was never legally organized. So for Epstein's lawyer to write a letter to the U.S. attorney in pursuit of a plea deal where he makes a statement that now, last Saturday, he claims he doesn't know if it's true or not, and he's proud of the result that he got from the plea deal, that seems pretty important to me, but they don't want to talk about that. And I thank you and InfoWars for allowing me on here to tell the public about this, because this is one of the things in the interview that they don't want to discuss. The whole thing sounds real weird. It's like this romantic meeting. He's giving him champagne and stuff like that. He's volunteering all this information. Why didn't Dershowitz simply say to me, look, I'm here to talk to you about the Constitution, Michael Flynn, Emmett Sullivan, and Andrew Cuomo?
Yeah, no, these are celebrations of agreements. It's like he's meeting with them after agreements have been made between intelligence agencies.
But not only that, Alex, why didn't Dershowitz say to me, look, attorney-client privilege survives the death of the client?
Yeah, why is he, like, talking about it? And like, oh, I'm charging full price.
He's trying to plant a story. He's trying to plant a story.
What about these other clips?
Right. So the second clip remind me what the second clip was about.
Well, it's no big deal. It's this clip, too. It's 18 minutes long. Is that how long this clip is, guys?
No, I don't think we want to run that.
Oh, it's 1 minute long. This is the Dersh claims no knowledge of his own signature. Here it is. Let's go ahead and play it.
And were you representing him in 2007 when this letter that Yahoo News?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
Isn't it a concern, Professor Dershowitz, if your name is on a letter as his lawyer? This Clinton Global Initiative was never legally organized and has no.
I don't know anything about it. Very common. It's the first I've known about this particular relationship. You mean I've heard that he was involved with Clinton's fundraising. I know they went to, I think they flew to Asia together for some Clinton initiative matter. But you have to ask other people about that. I just don't know about it. It's probably true if it was in the letter. And you know, this is what 13 years ago, so I have no current record. But I would not be nothing embarrassing about that if he was part of the Clinton Global Initiative. It would be the right thing.
Well, it's an illegally organized.
Nobody
it's an illegally anything. Organized violation of the IRS's well, code nobody, relating to 501c3 charities.
All right, we're going to go to break. Come back with clip number three. Dersh calls conspiracy theory the famous New York Post photo of Maxwell at a In-N-Out Burger. We're going to come back and talk about that with our guests for two more segments, and then we've got Dr. Nick Begich, great political mind, taking over the last few segments. Then Owen Schroyer is coming up. I'll be back this Sunday, by the way, 4 to 6 p.m. Central. I'm doing that Sunday show live. The crew's trying to talk me out of doing Memorial Day live so they get a day off, but we'll see what happens with that. But I got to tell you, these dudes aren't just into screwing young girls. It's about compromising people. It's about blackmail. And it's all these intelligence agencies that are involved, and the chickens are coming home to roost. I don't care who's involved. They all need to be exposed. We'll be right back. Stay with us. All right, we're back live. Jason Goodman is with us. Two more segments. This is a short segment. Jason, I want to play this other clip with your Epstein lawyer talk with Alan Dershowitz. But let me just ask you this. As a smart investigative journalist, been around, I don't know, more than a decade, we can talk about, everybody fetishizes it, British intelligence, Israeli intelligence, U.S. intelligence. Anybody that studies this, these aren't even intelligence agencies. It becomes these big mafias of corporate power, and it's corporations and foundations above it. But from your deep research, we know that Maxwell, you know, Epstein's big madam, you know, her dad died on a boat. He was involved blackmailing people for the MI6 and the Israelis and the CIA. I mean, is there any way to put a finger on who runs this?
Well, I don't know that I can do that, but I'm glad you brought up Robert Maxwell, because he seems to have been good friends with Rupert Murdoch. They're photographed together throughout the decades.
And yeah, they're heavily involved in radio, TV, and print.
Correct. Rupert Murdoch owns News Corp, which in the United States controls Fox News and the New York Post. The New York Post has put out tons of information. Well, Rupert Murdoch also has his Murdoch Children's Research Institute, which is developing a COVID-19 vaccine. So isn't that a conflict of interest for their news show to be telling us things about COVID-19
vaccines? Sure, and who is Rupert Murdoch going back to Australia? He clearly has intelligence ties to the Crown.
Well, and he was implicated in the United Kingdom in a phone hacking scandal, which sounds a lot more like espionage than journalism to me. But he's photographed with Ghislaine Maxwell. His New York Post is essentially the clearinghouse for information about Jeffrey Epstein and his death, the whereabouts of Ghislaine Maxwell.
So are you implying at the heart of this is a British intel op?
I can't say for sure, Alex, but I think they're involved. I think all of these intelligence agencies are a big club, and it supersedes nations, you know.
They're very incestuous.
Yes, that's right. They act as one giant unit, and they're acting against us. They don't care about the Constitution. They don't care about the law. They just care about power, control, and the money they need to do it. So here we see Maxwell with Rupert Murdoch, and she's also been featured in the New York Post, this obviously retouched photograph connected to a false story. I've spoken to the woman who took the photograph, as indicated by the EXIF data on the JPEG image on the NewYorkPost.com.
So it's a real photo.
Well, it's a retouched photo, and the story is false based on, you know,
so she's saying that the location's right, but the photo's been retouched.
I don't know. I called In-N-Out Burger to ask them if they would turn over their closed-circuit TV footage to the FBI on the day that Ghislaine Maxwell was allegedly there.
Sure,
so we
but what about her? Exactly. Okay, the photo's staged then. The book tells us what the real message is.
That's what I think. I think that, you know, she's reading this book called The Book of Honor, The Secret Lives of the CIA. When you go to Amazon.com, the first review is from Ghislaine Maxwell. And I believe that's a steganographic message for someone through the New York Post, through Amazon.com.
Well, obviously, it's like when you kidnap somebody holding up the newspaper day.
Right.
They're saying,
right,
hey, we're spies that have lost our lives in war. You better watch out.
There's something. I don't know what the message means, but I feel like it's a message. When I questioned the New York Post journalists, when I questioned Leah Safian, they acted very strange. When I brought this up to Alan Dershowitz, he said it was a conspiracy theory. He got super angry, and he hung up the phone. He lost his mind, practically.
We're going to play that clip when we come back. Wow. Well, you've got to come on more. I was familiar with work many years ago, and then, not putting you down, but one of the guys you were working with was, you know, cuckoo land.
I got socially engineered by him, Alex. I totally understand.
No, listen, with us, we didn't tell you what to say, right? We just had you on. We're real, man.
Yep.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We're straight up. With these people, like, I'm the opposite of calculated. Like, it's just straight up with me. And there's so many great researchers that get glommed onto by these people. And then I just want to get the truth, man. And let me tell you, you judge a tree by its fruits. You have done amazing work. And we just need more people like you. So when we come back, I want to ask you then about this last clip and where you think this is going. And some people say Epstein didn't really die. I think they did kill him to get rid of it. But maybe I'm wrong. We'll talk about it all on the other side with our guest, Jason Goodman. And then we will also then have the great patriot, Dr. Dick Baggage, take over. And then I'll be back this Sunday. This is just exhausting. The whole thing's exhausting. I can't figure it out anymore. It's all insane. And I just wonder why these people are like this. Like, they just can't help it. It's like there's something wrong with them. Because me, it's just all straightforward, but everybody else is like creeping around and doing weird stuff. It's just crazy. We'll be right back. Well, I can tell you all hell is breaking loose right now that we're talking about Jeffrey Epstein. We're talking about Alan Dershowitz. And I'm not a political animal. I just promote basic human freedoms. I'm not hooked into D.C. I'm not hooked into all this stuff. I do what I want here on air. And my guests come on, and they talk about whatever they want. We're not sitting here controlling what happens. We want the truth to come out. Jason Goodman has another clip here. Dersh calls a conspiracy theory the famous New York Post photo of Maxwell in the In-Out Burger. He was just talking about it. Here's the clip.
Things that have happened with Ghislaine Maxwell. I don't know if you saw this photo of her at an In-N-Out Burger in Los Angeles, but it appeared in the New York Post. And there were a number of problems with this from an evidentiary standpoint. This photo appeared in 2019, and I'm sure you're aware Ghislaine Maxwell is about 57 years old. This is quite obviously a retouched photo, and her complexion is not the only element of it that's been altered. When I brought this to the attention of the journalists at the New York Post and Ghislaine Maxwell's attorney, they all behaved very strangely. She's reading a book called The Secret Lives of CIA Operatives. When you go to Amazon.
Which attorney did you speak to?
Leah. What's her last name? She's in Ventura County. I forget her last name, but her information was on this photograph. She had taken the photograph, which the New York Post said was taken.
What's the relevance of the photograph? Let's assume it's a fake photograph. What does it show?
The New York Post is publishing a false story that seems
Why?
To be Well, why is the question that I've been trying to ask, but when I asked that question, In-N-Out Burger threatened to sue me and threatened to bring criminal action against me, which I think is a violation of the California Code of Ethics.
How could they possibly sue for expressing an opinion or bring criminal charges for expressing an opinion? You have expressed
because I called In-N-Out Burger and spoke to their media representative and asked if they would provide video footage from their surveillance system to the FBI so that people could locate Ghislaine Maxwell. She was accused of all kinds of things, and this was right after Jeffrey Epstein had died. I would think that the FBI would want to question one of his closest associates, but instead, it seemed like the New York Post was publishing an article that was filled with strange errors, at least, if not deliberate lies.
And Jason, you're saying he hung up right after that?
Well, shortly after that, I mean, you can notice even just in that clip, Alex, I mean, this is a man who is very experienced at interrogating people, cross-examining people, and when you're in court, there
he
is
a very...
He looks
like a deer in the headlights when you bring up Ghislaine Maxwell.
Exactly, and he won't let me finish a sentence. I'm trying to fill him in on the details, but he's just interrupting me and preventing me from sharing the details, and he calls it a conspiracy theory, but I'm describing to him evidence of a conspiracy. I spoke to three different people who refused to answer pertinent questions about obviously incorrect things in the New York Post. I should also mention, just a month prior, the New York Post ran a story about somebody who found an In-N-Out Burger on the street in Queens. Now, mind you, the closest In-N-Out Burger is in Texas. This one allegedly came from San Diego by plane and landed on the ground in Queens. Now, from my previous career in Hollywood, I have a lot of friends who work in commercial television and stuff. Spoke to a friend of mine who's a professional food stylist, and she said there's no way that you could drop a hamburger even from waist height and have it land on the street and look that good. Somebody got the paper from In-N-Out Burger, made a hamburger in Queens, and put that there. So they followed up two times on this story about the hamburger. First, they said, some executive from In-N-Out Burger says we have no idea how that got there. And then the second follow-up was a 16-year-old girl who said she dropped it out of her backpack. So they have two follow-up stories on a
stupid
throwaway.
Sure, so there's a PSYOP. It was a message. What do you think the message was?
It's hard for me to say, but when I try to get to it, everybody I ask acts super twitchy and blinky and doesn't want to answer questions.
Look, they wanted to compromise major scientists, so they had him sex with underage girls and got them compromised. And the question is, why did it all unravel? Why did Trump's election cause all this to unravel?
Well, I hope it is because Trump is making a concerted effort to drain the swamp. I'm very concerned about William Barr, particularly his recent statements that he doesn't think the John Durham investigation at this point is going to lead to criminal investigation of Joe Biden or Barack Obama. Then we've got this investigation in Ukraine where they're releasing literally phone calls of Biden engaging in quid pro quo.
I was about to say, it'd be one thing if the deep state backed off. They're not backing off. So why is Barr acting like, you know, because I don't want to just war for war's sake, but I mean, if the deep state won't back off the American recovery and they're working for Chi-Coms, exactly, why is Barr saying he's not going to go after them?
Yes, coming up next is Diana West talking about The Red Thread, her book, and some of the information she has about some of the individuals and their ties back to Marxist communist thought. Here we go now.
They are not there upholding their constitutional oaths, and in fact, they are trashing them. And when you actually look at some of the very cold, I would say Marxist beliefs behind these people that seem to animate them, they are deceiving us as to who they really are, and they are trying to enact their own visions of what the polity should be, irrespective of these oaths and irrespective of the people's will.
Is it possible that communist ideology has infiltrated America's intelligence agencies? After looking into key figures involved in the Spygate scandal, what information did Diana West uncover about their beliefs? And how is Donald Trump a counter-revolutionary president in West's view? This is American Thought Leaders, and I'm Yanya Kelek. In this episode, we'll sit down with Diana West, a journalist and author of The Red Thread, a search for ideological drivers inside the anti-Trump conspiracy.
Diana West, wonderful to have you on American Thought Leaders.
Oh, wonderful to be here, Jan.
What motivated you to try to find this sort of common ideological thread? How did this happen?
Well, that's a really good question, because there was one thing, and it had to do with looking at the behaviors, the actions we were starting to learn about, say, a couple of years ago, on the part of these senior officials in Washington, that certainly, it may be argued, some of them are seditious. I mean, really serious actions against the rule of law in their efforts to take down this presidency, the campaign, undermine the transition, and it's just gone on and on. And I was just trying to get a sense of why they were so angry, why they were taking these resorting to these measures when America is known for the peaceful transition of power.
Right.
And normally, when one party goes out of power, the other party comes in, and the one that's out of power starts building their campaign for next time, and the power will change every 2 to 4 years, 6 years, 8 years at the most. But the pendulum swings, right. And normally these kinds of people will just wait till next time. And so we didn't see that. We saw all kinds of plotting going on that we were learning about, all kinds of just absolutely terrifying uses of our security agencies, the FBI, the CIA, and so on. So I'd wondered, who are these people? Why are they doing this? Why are they risking everything? Because, of course, if they are caught, and, you know, this is still an open question.
Yes.
If they are caught, they can lose everything, including their freedom, including certainly their pensions, including their reputation. So what was driving them? This was not normal American behavior. And this becomes a very difficult question to answer when you're looking at career public officials, people who have tremendous resumes. They head the FBI, they head the CIA, they work in the Justice Department. You really can't get very far outside of their public persona. In 2017, it was actually December, we had a real break in the whole story, and that was by James Rosen, who was then with Fox News, and he wrote about this very interesting couple, Bruce and Nellie Orr. Bruce Orr being the high-ranking Justice Department official who was a liaison between Christopher Steele and the justice world, as we learned. And his wife, Nellie, who worked for Glenn Simpson at Fusion GPS, the shop that created the Steele dossier. Well, Nellie, it turned out, had been an academic. She was a professor in the 1990s, and that meant that there were going to be writings, publicly available writings, book reviews, for example, a PhD thesis, and so on, that I could at least look at to try to get a better sense of who she is. And indeed, it turns out she is a Russia expert. She speaks the language. She taught the subject. She got a PhD in it, in history, at Stanford after Harvard. And she studied in the Soviet Union, when it was still the Soviet Union. And I ended up putting together in the Red Thread kind of an ideological profile of Nellie Orr. She's my first case, in which I did learn that she had a very soft spot, believe it or not, for the regime of Joseph Stalin.
Fascinating.
Terrifying. But it is something where she talked about kind of on the one hand and on the other hand. In other words, she would talk about the terror, this is a quote, the terror and excitement of the Stalin era. She was talking about the frustration in a book review of trying to teach about this era to her students at Vassar.
Okay.
In the 1990s. Terror, I can understand. Excitement. So you look a little further and you find that she similarly applauded Stalin for trying to build a legal structure. This is what she called the agonizing paradox of Stalin's era, trying to build a legal structure on the one hand and yet executing innocent civilians on the other hand. I mean, this is the kind of attitude. It's kind of a moral equivalent attitude, really,
right.
When you're looking at this bloodthirsty regime that killed millions and millions of people. The legal structure was a sham if you're executing innocent civilians, of course, but this was very clearly a theme of her writings, and indeed including in her PhD thesis. And I learned that she followed a school of history in American academia known as revisionism. It is a revisionism. There have been a number, but it was one that came about in the 60s and 70s that was essentially promoted by straight up Marxists, and the new left, what we used to call the new left in this country, which really wasn't much different from the old left. It was usually their children. But they took over really the departments on the college campuses. And they are a school that writes about itself and has its stars and so on. And she very clearly followed in this school. Those people are the people she thanks, who are essentially her mentors, people she studied at Harvard and so on. So it became pretty clear that there was a red thread, if you will, here in terms of a openness to communist ideology as it was put into practice.
And a willingness to see someone like Stalin, who we know his history, you know, extremely well, in this sort of positive, apologetic light.
Yes, shocking.
Yeah,
absolutely shocking. I mean, so she was sort of case number one, and you know, it goes on from there. But that kind of gives you a flavor of what I was finding with Nellie Orr. It always intrigued me. She does have a CIA credential. She worked for their open source shop. So we know she had a CIA connection. Interesting. We also know that she took out a ham radio operator's license in the spring of 2016.
Oh, right. So you're thinking, who's she talking to?
Who's she talking to? Yeah. We don't know the answers to these questions, but she becomes a very interesting figure and very important in this entire
extremely
movement.
For multiple reasons, right? I mean, if you believe Lee Smith, you know, she's very instrumental actually in the creation of the Steele dossier in the first place. And now that we have, you know, the IG report that has come out fairly recently, it's auspicious that we're having this interview. Actually, so we know a lot more about how, let's say, wrong or false the Steele dossier was through and through.
Garbage. Right.
Right, right, right. That's a good, that's a good word, right?
It's been used.
So you also looked at Christopher Steele.
Yes.
In the book.
Yes.
What did you find? I mean, I know a little bit, but tell me.
Yes. Well, he seemed like the next person to try to crack a little bit into the shell of, because essentially if she had a little CIA connection, which has not really been fully disclosed, in other words, we don't really know if she knows John Brennan from her past or what have you, another person in this group, Christopher Steele, as a former intelligence officer for the British, is almost her opposite number at Fusion GPS, and it's his name obviously on the dossier. And there's very little about him as an intelligence officer, given that is not a very public profession.
Yes, of course.
But when he burst on the scene, the British press were looking at him, and one of the first things came out, he was a very prominent student at Cambridge in the 1980s. Around the same age as Nellie Orr, also graduated in the 1980s. And Christopher Steele was the head of the very storied Cambridge Debating Society, the Cambridge Union. I believe at the same time, the new Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, was the head of the Oxford Union.
Okay.
So you see the kind of people these are. And when Christopher Steele was this prominent Cambridge student, he was known, and this is in a history of the Cambridge Union, he was known as a confirmed socialist.
Wow.
Right. Exactly. And when you look at that, that was twinned with some reporting by the Daily Mail that stated that he was also somebody who had CND credentials.
Mm-hmm.
CND goes back to that same period. CND was Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament.
Right.
It was essentially a Marxist front group that was very much in sync with Soviet Union foreign policy goals to remove American nuclear weapons from Europe. And they were riddled with actual Marxists. Some think there was also support from the Soviet Union of the whole group. Certainly that also included a number of very sincere, peaceable people who were hoping to do right by the world. But this would be a place where Christopher Steele had some involvement. We don't know the extent of it. But interesting, because it certainly is a hard left type of credential. And the fact that he left Cambridge and was hired then by MI6 and then posted in Moscow with these kinds of politics is just another one of these shocking happenings that we're seeing replicated everywhere, which tells you a lot about MI6. You would think they might have learned. They had a number of Soviet agents out of Cambridge, the very famous Cambridge Five, for example. So you'd think they'd be more careful. But what is their culture? We can learn a little bit about that from this kind of a hire. Christopher Steele also was known to others with, you know, very edgy in terms of his politics. He has the distinction of bringing in the first PLO representative to the Cambridge Union. And this was a time when the United States and Israel still considered the Palestinian movement to be a terrorist organization, I mean, officially. So this was a big deal at that time to essentially normalize that particular group with that kind of an very prestigious invitation. So you see where his politics are. I always wondered, you know, given when Donald Trump burst on the scene in the spring of 2016 with his foreign policy speech, he spoke specifically about essentially revamping Americans' nuclear arsenal.
Yes.
I also wondered if that perhaps might have given Christopher Steele added reason to try to oppose him. You know, we don't know where Christopher Steele's politics are on that particular point, but given his animus against Donald Trump, I wouldn't be surprised to learn that he still had those same feelings.
When reading the book,
yeah,
you know, there's all these kind of specific items of information that you've managed to dig out. It's remarkable. And you get this kind of feeling of, you know, there is this just kind of dominating ideology here, and it's a left ideology, right? This is, I think, what you're showing.
Yes.
And this particularly comes out in, you know, someone who's actually been in the news again, front and center, of course, the former director of the FBI,
yes,
Mr. Comey.
Yes.
And that, what you found around Comey is, again, you know, fascinating. I mean, there's some of it is known, and some of it is, I guess, less known. I mean,
yes,
can you
sure,
expand
I'd love to
a little bit here? Because
yes,
this is, I think this seems like one of the deepest dives you do, right?
Yes, well,
yeah,
it, thanks to Comey's own writings and
right,
public statements, because all of this is open source, obviously, and it's, you know, mainly their own words that I'm looking at, or reports about them. So I think that one way to think of them helpfully is really anti-democratic, small d, anti-democratic, anti-election, anti-the people. I mean, this is the great irony of the left, I suppose.
But well-meaning? I mean, this is...
I don't know.
You know, okay.
I can't really speak to intent.
Okay.
You know, certainly there are well-meaning people in this same general movement, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of intent by James Comey, I couldn't speak to it. I have to sort of look at... For this exercise, I'm just looking at trying to understand what he believes. And the first clue comes from an interview he gave in 2003. And this was with New York Magazine. And he was just about to be elevated from... He was working in the Southern District of New York as a federal prosecutor. And he was just about to be elevated to be the number two man at the Justice Department under George W. Bush.
Okay.
John Ashcroft was the mm-hmm. Attorney General. And the New York Magazine writer thought it was a very strange pairing because Comey, even though he was considered to be a Republican, was kind of an edgy punk rock type, whereas John Ashcroft was known as a very, you know, conservative,
yes,
Christian, constitutional.
Very Christian.
Very,
yeah,
yes,
yeah, yeah.
And criticized for this and by the media, I should mm-hmm. say. But Comey was telling this reporter, kind of a giddy interview, and I suspect, because he knew he was going to be getting this phone call confirming his appointment, the reporter thought he was just laughing all the time, and maybe because he was about to join this rarefied ranks of power in the Justice Department. But anyway, he told the reporter that when he was in college, he had been a communist, and that he didn't really know what his politics were. This would be about 20 years later, but whatever they were, you know, he was different, I suppose, but he hadn't really figured it out yet, which I thought was an interesting statement, not exactly a fire-breathing anti-communist, to be sure, but leave it there. So I thought, well, what can we learn about the period where he was a communist? And William & Mary, his alma mater, has posted online, very helpfully, their senior papers by their students.
Okay.
And so I was able to find John Comey's senior thesis, which was about his lifelong mentor. This is somebody very important to him to this day, the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, and Jerry Falwell was the other subject of this paper, Jerry Falwell being the leader, the founder of the Moral Majority. And Comey was juxtaposing their views of the Christian in politics.
Okay.
So it's an interesting paper. And Jerry Falwell's view was that you should take Christian morality into the political realm and follow the Ten Commandments, basically. And Reinhold Niebuhr was that you should ditch your Christian teachings and work for his definition of justice, which was essentially a very coercive redistribution of power and wealth, which sounds very Marxist.
Yes.
Well, Reinhold Niebuhr was very Marxist. So it would appeal to a young James Comey, the communist. Reinhold Niebuhr was somebody who was a member of the Socialist Party. He lobbied very heavily for the United States to recognize the Soviet Union in the 1930s. He belonged to numerous communist front groups, judged that way by the Attorney General under Roosevelt. These were official communist front groups, according to the Attorney General. And Reinhold Niebuhr had very high-ranking positions with them. In that period, he actually advocated the use of force to change our social order. There's a headline I found from the 1930s where he'd gone to a college campus. This is Reinhold Niebuhr. And the reason I even bring this up is this was not just a youthful flirtation of James Comey, because Comey, to this day, when he's asked who his influences are, the very first one is Reinhold Niebuhr.
Right.
He even notes the first two books that were most important to him coming from the same most militant period of Niebuhr's life, the 1930s, where Niebuhr really was talking about revolution as a possibility, possibly justified. And the kinds of things that Comey writes about in his thesis are chilling in light of his rising to the heights of our justice system and the FBI.
Right.
He basically says that that there are position times when an evil action, this is a paraphrase but very close, an action may be evil but not necessarily immoral given the circumstances. So this is where you start to see Comey, the actor who will, for example, decide not to take it on himself to even take the role of the Attorney General to decide not to indict Hillary Clinton, for example, out of the circumstances. I mean, this is where you start seeing the ends justify the means, notion that he knows what the higher good is.
Okay.
He talks about the, again, distilling Niebuhr, that the Christian in politics must leave his Christian beliefs when he is actually acting in politics and must be willing to sin in the name of justice. This is another one of Comey's beliefs from this senior thesis. And again, we might say, well, he's 22 years old. However, this Niebuhr affinity still is something he is the first to tell you about. So I think it's valid to explore Niebuhr's beliefs. And also the fact that Niebuhr taught Comey's professor at William & Mary,
right,
as did a Frankfurt School member that Niebuhr taught with, Paul Tillich. That becomes interesting when you're doing this sort of notion of a red thread, when you look at a very young Hillary Clinton, who really was, we might say, radicalized in her youth by her youth minister, her Methodist youth ministry. It's a well-known story that I think Barbara Olson first wrote about years ago. And this youth minister by the name of Jones was assigning his charges, Reinhold Niebuhr and Paul Tillich. So we're seeing the same influences. Same intellectual influences. And this is essentially what the book tries to do, is to try to go where intellectual biography lies. Because I think we miss a lot when we don't study the motivations and study the influences on these very important people whose policymaking reflect these early and very serious, these are serious people. Comey, well, Clinton, and so on.
Top of the power structure,
right,
in America.
Right, and they share these same kinds of early formative influences and carry them through, I believe, to this day. I think you can certainly make that case.